Now, for you overseas visitors, and those of us who live in Cape Town who think that South Africa ends at the Hex River, Mpumalanga is somewhere in the northeast side of the country and fairly near Kruger National Park, which will put it in context for you. But not by the furthest stretch of imagination could it be said that she has had a privileged upbringing. However, that speech at the age of 11 gave her the confidence in school to speak from stage, and now a decade and a half later, she is impressing and energizing numerous audiences all around this country with her passion and her energy. On leaving school, she applied for the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation Scholarship. This foundation does amazing work in South Africa, especially in the field of social entrepreneurship, and she was awarded one of their prestigious scholarships. I've no doubt that after her talk this afternoon, you're going to understand why she impressed them so much and why she has emerged some years later from Wits University with a BSc degree in civil engineering and latterly a master's degree. She's now a risk and strategy manager in an executive position at one of South Africa's leading engineering companies. Her long-stated goal has been to make a significant impact on South Africa's manufacturing industry, and in doing so, make a difference in improving our employment problems. She is once described on television as being one of a new breed of young leaders in business who is setting a new tone and direction for what leadership is all about. This is what she said in a recent interview. A passive student never helps any situation. Our students in this country have to build up assertive thinking, taking an active part in their own education, and exploiting every resource in order to enhance their own learning. Our youth must move away from the paradoxically comforting mentality of dependency. In that way, they will give themselves a better shot at turning their generation around. Our young people in Africa have to step up and take a lead. Well, Susie in her short career has certainly done that. Whatever country and whatever community you come from and whatever school you're in, you're no doubt always trying to pass on that same sentiment and self-belief to the boys in your school. In keeping with our theme of lessons from Madiba, Susie will be discussing Mandela's views on Africa, his approach to economic transformation, and what the rest of Africa meant to him. She will also discuss the lessons she has learned in her personal journey. Susie Nekambule.
You've been messing with Google. Hi, everyone. Can you all hear me at the back? I find podiums very restricting, so I'll walk over there every now and then to remind myself so I don't forget something important. They gave me this very fun gadget, so let's all assume that I'm telepathically controlling the slideshow. As he has so very eloquently said, and I have no idea who you're speaking about, my name is Susie. And I was born in this very beautiful country of ours. I love South Africa. I love Africa more. And I've made it my life's work, well, as short as it's been so far, to try and understand better what the issues are and what we can all do. Teachers are my favorite people because the first person to have made a real impact in my life was a teacher. The person who made me give that speech when I was 11 was a teacher. Then the person who made me formalize my love of public speaking when I was in high school was my English teacher. And then the person who made me fall in love with visualizing and engineering was my math teacher. So teachers are very important people in my life. I don't think there are any more important people than educators. And unfortunately, I'm not Oprah, so I can't give away gifts. All right. So today I'm going to try and take you through a very quick snapshot of my life, just to reflect on the issues, but also more importantly to just give you guys context as to what an average African child experiences and how to transcend all of that. I'm assuming that my story is some version of a correct representation of transcendence. And then I'm going to discuss my current passion, which is Africa. But I'm going to relate all of this back to things that Mandela believed, what we should have all done. And The big question is, why now? Why should we be talking about Mandela's lessons now? Why should it matter? Well, if you're coming from the States, all I have to say is Charleston. Then you remember why it's important that we talk about it now. You have to ask yourself, the xenophobic attacks, or Afrophobia as it's called, in South Africa, and what that says about where civilization is now. You have to ask yourself about ISIS, and what that says about where civilization is now. So there's a lot we can learn from the great man. I personally have read every single book, biography, autobiography, or whatever it is that they call them, that's been written about Mandela. I find his life story very fascinating, because for someone to have that kind of patience and clarity over decades is rare. And people like that don't come through in our lifetime. We haven't seen very many of them. To have that kind of clarity and conscience and consciousness that lasts decades, even when he's locked away all by himself. So this, for me, is the most important thing that Mandela has ever said. If you've watched the Long Walk to Freedom film, this is what he said on the dock when he was being trialed for treason. And I've highlighted the red words because they represent what the man stood for. Mandela stood for democracy, harmony, and equal opportunity. Those are the three things that you could say summarize the man. He wanted people to have the right to choose the state of society that they lived in. He wanted their vote to matter. It didn't matter whether they were a woman, a man, they were black, Indian, or white. He just wanted them to have a right to choose. He wanted people to learn to live harmoniously. So cohesion was a very important thing to him, and tolerance was an even more important thing to him. So tolerance is recognize that people are different, but be okay with that and live within it. And equal opportunity is a big issue at this point, particularly for our country. We have a massive scar that comes from apartheid, and you always ask yourself, how do you balance? And we have legislation, a whole bunch of acts, and that are always trying to fix the transformation gap that we have in the country. Whether they're working or not working, it depends on which side of the scale you sit. There are people that they work great for, and there are people that they don't work great for. Now we need to ask ourselves whether or not those acts are the most effective way to achieve the primary goal. But if you read that statement, you understand what the man stood for. Now I don't think there's any country in the world that can say that that doesn't matter, that that's not what we want. We want democracy, we want harmony, and we want equal opportunity for all of our people. Because if we have that, then the world wouldn't have problems. So he obviously liked you guys, as much as I do. Because education was probably one of the most important things to the man. And post-liberation in South Africa, his big issue was around how to fix the Bantu education scourge. And Bantu education, I understand, because I have an entire family that was educated under Bantu education. So I started the first grade in 94. So I'm a, what would they call them, freedom babies. The born frees, or whatever it is that they call it in this country. And sometimes it's the right tag, and sometimes it's just plain ridiculous. But I started my education in 1994. So in the 12 years of schooling that I had, I saw a lot of change. I saw a lot of changes in curriculums. I saw a lot of changes in how, in the teaching staff. I saw a lot of changes in just the system and how it worked. And predominantly, those were all good changes, movements in the right direction. I have concerns about changes I've seen in the last 5 years or so. Because when I was in school, the most important thing was that passivity was not tolerated. It just wasn't. As a student, you can't be here and not be here. It doesn't make any sense. So no one's supposed to be spoon-feeding you. It was self-driven learning. And the most successful kids who go on to college and shoot out the stars are the kids who get that while they're in high school. That if you want to learn, and you want to learn very effectively, drive it yourself. Don't wait to be spoon-fed. Because the minute you get to college, everyone stops spoon-feeding you, and then they fail. So South Africa's education system is struggling. Africa's education system varies depending on which country you're in. There are some countries with excellent education systems, Zimbabwe being one. But overall, the issue doesn't change that we have a quickly growing population of people who are leaving matric, in this country the 12th grade, who are leaving matric and flooding the job market, and there's nowhere for them to get employed. And when they don't get employed, they're bored, they don't have anything to do, and eventually they see Susie in her car, and they want Susie's car, and then that conversation doesn't go down very well. So what I wanted to speak about, just very quickly, I won't spend a lot of time on this, is my basic education and what I learned from it. So I went to a township school. Now, there's a very specific definition of what a township school is. It's under-resourced, it typically doesn't have a lot of qualified teachers, and from a science and technology perspective, you can basically assume that it has nothing. So it has the basics. So you'll have an English, maths, you'll have an English language, traditional languages, history, bit of commerce, and you struggle even more and more the more you get to the technical sciences in terms of the competencies of the teachers and the resources. So I spent 5 years of my life at Busisiwe High School. That's what it looked like in 2012. Busy trying to change it. I kind of wanted it to look better. So every now and then I go back and we add something with my friends. And it's a very simple school. It's got all the classrooms, but it had no tech, nothing, no computers. The best reliance I had was my teachers. And the best resource I then had was the local library. So that's all I had when I was a teenager. There was no fancy cell phone where I could access whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted, which is the one thing I don't understand about kids these days. They have everything, but they know nothing. All right. So Susisiwe High School is made up of that bunch of very amazing people there. And that bunch of people educates 1,200 children in three blocks. Those blocks you're looking at there, there's three of them. The one at the latter end is half the size of all the others. So the average classroom size, about 60 odd kids against one teacher. So it's not an easy situation. Hardly at all. And then the resourcing is also very, very low. So it's getting better as time goes, but when I was in high school, that's what we knew and that's what we worked with. And that's why, I don't even remember saying what you quoted me saying, but my big issue is you work with what you're given. You don't sit and wait for the things that you don't have. Because the world is flat and you can access anything. And with technology, you can teach yourself anything online. So I don't understand why I seriously take issue with it whenever I'm mentoring young kids in townships and they tell me they didn't know. It's a very, very invalid excuse in my head. I didn't know, it doesn't work. I didn't know that I need more than 60% on my maths grade in order to get into engineering school, to even just be anywhere near the landing bar. If you tell me you didn't know, get out of the room. Because it means you're not serious about being an engineer. Because if you were serious about being an engineer, that's the first thing you would have looked up. So I'm not very patient when it comes to how to teach kids. I leave that to you guys, because I only show up once every 3 months and kick them and then walk out. but this was my education. And what this taught me more than anything was that you can do anything if you set your mind right. And that the world will never stop you. So that's the one thing that everyone always misunderstands, is that the world is actually working actively to stop you. I'm yet to find someone standing in my way saying don't. I have a lot of people who say, it's probably not a smart idea, it'll be very, very difficult, but there's yet a person to say to me don't. Whether for racial reasons, gender reasons, or whatever it is, I'm yet to find someone standing in front of me saying don't. And I'm really, really wishing one person comes up, because then I'll finally use all of those judo classes I've been taking. But, so you understand, that's my background, that's where I come from, it doesn't define me. And that's the one thing I'm always trying to teach kids wherever I go. And I only mentor kids from previously disadvantaged backgrounds. Because you don't have to be defined by where you come from. So that's the one danger about a life lacking privilege, is that it becomes a box. It's like race. If you are in the whatever classification of racial lines you work on, and you're somewhere near the bottom of the food chain, whether you're black or whatever it is, you need to be very careful about making sure that your own skin color doesn't become a cage for you. So where I come from doesn't define me. It just happens to have been one thing that happened in my life, and I learned a lot from it, because I found in my work it's easier for me to relate to people because of where I come from. It's easier for me to transcend and speak to people from all kinds of walks of life because of where I come from. I don't have the issue of I don't understand. I understand what it's like to be poor. I'm slowly but surely trying to pretend I understand what it's like to be rich, though I never will. You know, so for me, that was a gift. It's the one aspect of my existence I would never change. So my journey is, I went off to this university and I studied civil engineering in a very diverse classroom of people. So Wits University is my favorite place on earth. They don't think that, because sometimes I'm very critical of the university when I write for the convocation, but how are they supposed to get better if the alumni don't push them? So it's my favorite place. So I will write something critical, and then 6 months later I'll go and enroll for a business school course. So obviously there's a very interesting relationship there. So I studied at Wits University. I did civil engineering. I did civil engineering because my big issue has always been infrastructure. If things are easier to do, if it's easier to get something from one point to another point, it's easier to do business. And if it's easier to do business, it's easier to create jobs. And if it's easier to create jobs, it's easier to move a society forward. It's a very simple equation. And that's Africa's problem. It's very difficult to just do things. It's difficult to drive on a road. It's difficult to get electricity. So South Africa currently ranks very poorly on the doing business rankings because of load shedding. And it's not because our electricity problem is dire. No, if you go to Nigeria, they have no power more often than they have power. But it's because people expect to have no power. So they buy generators, they put it into their capex, and the business fully assumes that there will never be power. In South Africa, the problem is you've told them they will have power. And then you cut it off for 3 hours and everybody loses their minds. So what I'm very passionate about is development. I've chosen one particular field, which is engineering. I've been working for the Avenge Group. For those of you who are interested, that is Medupi Power Station. I wonder if I'm allowed to even show that photo. That is Medupi Power Station. And it's late. And why is it late? Everyone goes on and on about, oh my goodness, it's a difficult engineering problem, da-da-da, whatever. That is a human error problem. An entire power plant is a human error problem. It's the labor. They are difficult, exceptionally so. Medupi, since it started, has probably lost easily 18 months of productive time due to labor unrest. Now, the labor problem in this country is reflective of the entitlement issue that he was mentioning that people have. So labor in this country doesn't sit down and say, I'm a partner in your business. It says, I'm your adversary. And since business and government don't talk, it's just a nightmare. So labor is very politicized in this country. And how do you educate a kid who's coming out of high school that the industry that they're walking into is going to make decisions for them that impact their family without actually consulting them? Because if you talk to 90% of the people who are sitting out there outside in Marikana at the strike, they're just there because they were told to be there. They're not the instigators. They're just sitting there. There's the 10 guys at the front carrying the machetes, talking to the union rep, running the show, and you're seeing 3,000 people per problem, but your problem is probably about 200 of the entire 3,000. So my issue is passivity and entitlement is a problem. Take charge. Be a big part of your own existence. Make your own choices. Don't let people lead you. Because if people are going to lead you, you'll join the wrong union. Why do you even need to join a union in the first place? Don't. I'm still waiting for Parliament to pull a Margaret Thatcher moment, because I really think that's what our labor unions need in this country. But that's the industry I work in, so I get to do a lot of fun stuff. We build some complicated things. We go around in Africa. We're building a whole bunch of things across the border. And the company I work for has a sister company in Australia as well. So from a work-life perspective, my job is fun. The challenge is making sure that South African corporate understands that it has a bigger role to play in terms of development. But luckily, I run strategy, so half of my job is always convincing people how to do something differently instead of the archaic 50-year-old way of doing it. The other very favorite part of my life is that group of people, the Association of Alan Gray Fellows. The Alan Gray Orbis Foundation is probably quite easily the most impactful organization I've come across in terms of how it looks at the potential of young people. So they have a very simple formula. I will identify a talent in you, I will educate you, and then I will ignite you through making sure that you're constantly introduced to inspiring people who are aligned with what you want to do. I will let you loose on industry, and then I will back you. That's the Alan Gray strategy in a very simple form. Behind it, there's a very complex structure of very talented people who are running around making sure they're finding the best talent in the country, supporting them through college or high school now that they've got the scholars program, making sure that we're constantly connected to industry while we start working, which is where most of the association people are. Making sure that we stay connected to the idea of that overall transformative vision. Whether you start your own business or you go and run a big corporate and you change its mandate, those are Alan Gray Fellows. It's a bunch of kids who are actually crazy enough to think they can change the world, and they probably will. So there's about currently 260 odd alumni in the fellowship, and about 700 in the program, either in school or college or doing some other international residency type of training of some sort. So I have I've had a very great life, as I think of it, but I've barely done anything. So I always list these things every year as New Year's resolutions with revisions and action plans and all sorts of other things, so I'm very type A. My first issue is bridging the information access gap and mentoring young people. So last year, a bunch of friends and I were sitting. So we all are involved with a series of different organizations. I'm involved with the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation formally. And then I volunteered various other organizations. But we were sitting last year, and you probably won't like this because it's not about boys. We were sitting last year and we were saying, in townships, no one goes in there and just says, "Hi, my name is Susie. Ask me what you want to ask. I'm just here for 4 hours." From our generation anyway. We don't do that anymore. We always come in with formal things, through main programs or anything like that. We never just come in and say, there's a bunch of us here, there's an actuary, an engineer, there's an accountant, ask. We're here for 4 hours. So we started a trust that we initially funded out of our own pockets, and then we found out we had rich friends, so they just threw money at it, which helped. And then we took it to Soweto. And our initial assumption was that we'd be sitting there and obviously just doing general mentorship with the girls that we wanted to reach. And we very quickly found out that we had a big problem in our South African education system, which is when I talk about the last 5 years of regression. It's not a small problem. When you tell a child who's 15 years old that 30% is okay, they will never aim for 70. So when I come up and I say aim for 80, they go like, "Are you out of your mind?" So then I have to then create the impression that you're not anywhere near the playing field at 50. But the first time we did this one April in 2014 with 40 girls from Soweto who were in matric their last year. And of the entire bunch in the room, only one fully understood the implications of the grading structure and where they could get in, where they couldn't get in, just the limitations of how you should perform in high school and the doors it opens. The rest were shocked. It's quite sad when you sit there and you think you're just stating facts when you're actually crushing someone's dreams. Because they tell you they thought they could become an architect, but you just tell them they can't. It's impossible. And to add insult to injury, it's the fact that they don't have the resources to afford to bridge. So they can't go to an FET college and go and bridge for about 2 years and get their grades up and then go back to school. They need to work, and they need to work now, or they need to go to college. Their parents just simply can't afford it. They don't have the money. And then you're sitting there and you're saying to them, everything that they've been told up until this point has been completely irrelevant, because the world doesn't work on the system that they think the world works at. So it was in that moment that I suddenly became all of a sudden very politically vocal, when I'm typically apolitical, because I took issue with that, with the assumption that telling our children that 30% was okay wouldn't have permanent damage. And it does. It's a simple legislative thing, but immediately they pegged themselves there. And when they're doing the 50s, they think they're doing great because the bar's here. And then you're like, none of the kids in my first year engineering class were anywhere near 50. They were all at 70 as a minimum. So where do you think you're going to, how do you think you're going to come in sitting down here? So we've been doing a lot of work trying to bridge the information access gap, creating seminars, information packs, sessions across various schools in Soweto to just do the most basic thing, which is explain to kids where you should peg yourself as to, because how the world will measure you. And then what we had to change was we had to stop talking to the matrix, because it was too late for them. That sounds so cruel to say, but it was too late for them. We couldn't do much. So we started talking to the grade 10s, because they could do something about it. And hopefully the message will spread across the school through the information that we shared. So that's one issue, one big aspect of my life. That relates more to my work and my studies. I'm always flabbergasted whenever there's a market need that the market doesn't meet, because it means that there's something fundamentally wrong in economics. So I decided to study the infrastructure development problem that Africa has. Everyone always talks about a $100 billion a year funding gap. I'm like, okay, so you're telling me that someone needs a railway line and someone needs to fund it, and there's a train that needs to go on it, and there's someone else sitting somewhere else with money, but the money's not coming across. What's wrong? Why isn't economics working? So I spent a lot of time studying that in the last 18, 24 months or so, and I'll share with you in a second why Africa is kind of stuck there. And then the next one is political ideologies and current movements. Because I'm apolitical, this is fun for me, because I don't have an affiliation with any of them. I find the EFF as an idea fascinating. Dangerous, but fascinating. So the Economic Freedom Fighters used to be a tiny little irritation in the African National Congress's stable of a bunch of kids who were very vocal, who didn't like what was going on because they had been sidelined by the current leadership, and they said, fine, we're going to leave and we'll start our own thing. But they are very effective at mobilizing the youth. Why? Because they are radical. They are radical. And if you're going to speak up to a bunch of people who feel marginalized, who feel like nothing's changing, who don't understand the intricacies of economic policy, and you tell them, I can give you what you want and I can give it to you now if you follow me, and we will not let anyone stop us because we are not asking permission from anybody, people will get on that bus. Ignorance is their biggest friend. So the EFF itself is fascinating, but what's even more fascinating around Africa is the extinction of liberation movements like the ANC. So in all African countries, 90% of all of the movements that carried over from independence and ruled have not survived. 90% of them. So it's either they get killed off by a civil war, or there is an internal fracture, and a new political structure comes up. But none of them have survived. So I've been asking myself this question, trying to figure out, are they meant to become extinct anyway? And if they're meant to become extinct, what will that extinction process look like for the ANC? So it's a very interesting debate to always have and to always understand as to where African countries stand. And it's always fascinating when you bring these things into the classroom, because I started writing commentary papers for my English classes on various political and economic issues, simplified, of course, because I was only 14, when I was in like the eighth grade. So what our teacher would do is he'd come in, either there'd been a summit or there'd been a TV program or whatever it is, and either he would tell you to go watch it first and then come back, and he'll ask a series of questions and you had to write a paper on it. But what it did was it forced all of us to start thinking laterally beyond what our curriculum said. And he always picked the subjects very well. And for me, it was very useful because I used a lot of the material in my eventual public speaking engagements. But it pushed me to engage with issues that as a 14-year-old, I would not need to engage with. Because 14-year-olds don't really, they'll tell you straight, I don't care about politics. Ask me when I'm 19. But they should. This is the other fascinating one, When China Met Africa. There is a documentary on YouTube. Literally, just go on YouTube and say, When China Met Africa. It'll come up. It's PG, so you can play it in any classroom. So it's not violent or anything like that. But it gives you the sense of the Chinese-Africa interaction, that connection, and why the Chinese find Africa so liberating. Because China is quite rigid as a structure. Functions as an effective pyramid. So if you're at the bottom of the pyramid, the chances of you ever moving up in China are quite difficult. But Chinese people work very hard, and they say that they tend to understand a lot more about economics and logistics. So they just come to Africa and they do something small, and like buying three hectares of farm plot, and all of a sudden they've started a proper business and they're employing 150 people. So for me, that's a very interesting study to just continue to track what the Chinese-Africa connection is, and eventually, of course, what it will mean for the decentralization of power in the globe, or maybe the Easternization of global power. So that's more related to my work with the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation. We're always running around trying to figure out how do we grow small businesses, how do we make a more healthy entrepreneurial environment for young people. And the last one is the use of multimedia to retell the African story. Currently, I am very, very tired of reading about Africa, the dark continent, Africa, Ebola, Africa, blah, 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 Bashir, and all sorts of other negative representations of the continent. I think there's more to the African continent than that, and people need to just find it. So there's an opportunity there to use multimedia. So let's go through a quick lesson in African fragility. All right, so there's a lot of really great things about the continent. All right, so the population's very young. The average age in Africa is somewhere between 16 and 36. So the population is very young. And when a population is that young, it's ripe for industrialization. That's how China did it. China's current problem is that they have an aging population. That one child policy actually is going to kick them in about 10 years. And there's resource wealth in Africa. Most African countries have some form of resource. So they've got a primary industry that they can depend on. There is some improving political stability in some areas. And there's opportunities for economic diversification. What Nigeria has managed to do with the telecom sector is unparalleled in the space of in the amount of time they've actually done it. But we never hear about that story. The challenges for the continent is education. That's the big one. The illiteracy levels on this continent are appalling. People can't read, people can't write. Numeracy levels, even in a country as apparently advanced as South Africa, are so poor. And that basically means that the productivity of your people drops because they're not educated enough. Investability and ease of doing business. If you ever want to study these things, go to the World Bank Ease of Doing Business section. They dedicate an entire department with so many hundreds of people to just study ease of doing business. And they do Africa in quite a lot of detail. It's not an easy read, but it's interesting. The infrastructure backlog, as I'd mentioned, regional fragility, which I'll show you what I mean in a second, and the last one that doesn't show up there, I think I remember writing it somewhere, is the colonial hangover. It's actually quite a big problem. Can you all see that? Okay, let me try and explain it. So if you know what the structure of the African continent looks like, the countries that are not colored, except for the MENA region, which is up north, outside of sub-Saharan Africa, the countries that are clear are the countries that are considered by this study to be stable. It means it would take an act of God or a really, really big Boko Haram to destabilize the structure or to get them off the path that they're currently on. The countries that are yellow means they need another 15 years to get themselves perfectly stable. So it means you, in terms of regime change, so whenever there's an election or anything like that, you won't have problems. Whenever there's issues around massive investment, it moves into the country easier. Education levels should be improving. It means every single indicator that you have should be ticking up and not down. Those countries need another 15 years to get there. The ones that are orange need another 35. And then the red ones, which are the important ones here, they're countries that even by 2050, they'll be nowhere near stable. Now, what do I mean by the colonial hangover? So there was a clip that I wanted to play, and then I remembered while I was sitting at home over the weekend that I didn't want to depress you guys. It's a 4-minute clip that basically explains the European colonialization of Africa, and it's on YouTube. You can look it up. I think you need to search for the exact phrase is, if you're ever that curious, a brief history of European colonization in Africa. That's the exact phrase. It's a 4-minute clip. It simply explains to you where the Belgians went, where the French went, and where the English went, and then what they did when they were there. The little things that we are now having to deal with that they never thought would be big issues. So let me give you a good sense of what I mean. You all know about Rwanda and the genocide in Rwanda. That it was a clear result of the colonial hangover. What they did there was, I think it was the Belgians who were there, they used the south and the tribes that were from the south as, they basically sat down and they decided, we will educate this bunch, they will become our support in government, and we will source our labor force and policemen and all sorts of other things from the north. It's a simple decision, right? Shouldn't have any adverse effects. People are robots, of course. And that's what they did. But as the country went on, obviously that resulted in tensions between the tribes, because one group was progressing and having better access to things, and then the other group was not. So when you give them independence, it's quite clear which group will have more power over the other one. Fast forward a couple of decades, you get genocide. Sudan is exactly the same problem. The south of Sudan had the resources, it had the oil, but the seat of power was sitting in the north. So they used the south as their little production facility with all the labor, but they never developed it. And they kept the seat of power in the north. You give them independence, what happens? The south now wants to control the oil. And then boom, you have the Sudan civil war that has lasted for my entire life, basically. So what I'm trying to explain to you with this is that when you're trying to invest in Africa, and whether you're coming from the European markets or the Western markets or whatever it is, regional fragility is a big problem. Because, like I said, the world is flat, but Africa is even flatter. So when Zimbabwe collapsed, there was no war there, but there was a mass influx of Zimbabweans into South Africa. And the same thing happened in South Sudan. Whenever there were wars there, it moved over to Ethiopia, down to Kenya, down to Uganda. So fragility is a shared issue. So even though the other countries look like they're fine, their fate in terms of economic sustainability is still hinging on how well their neighbors look. And until we can solve this problem, and you know, short of building walls around every single country, until we can get a clear gauge as to where every single country is and move them all forward at the same time, this 25-year lag that all of the economists speak about in terms of how behind Africa is on development, it's not actually 25 years, it's more like 50 years. And it's going to keep growing. Because there are countries that are getting worse, they're not getting better. So it's a real challenge. But it's also a very great opportunity. So I'm always trying to find a bunch of kids who want to work in construction and who want to work across the border. And it's very hard, even in South Africa, without going anywhere else. In fact, I find that it's easier for me to find international people that are willing to go and work in the Democratic Republic of Congo than it is for me to convince a South African to go work in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So it's quite interesting. But what drives that? So here's a very simple explanation. Africans are very simple people. We have a very simple culture based on tribal law, right? But when you take that, add the colonial hangover, then add politics and assumed democracy, this is what you get. You get a political pact amongst the elite group, which, if you take the case of Ghana, was the group that was closest to the governor's house when the British left, as I like to think of it. So they do a political pact. So power is concentrated, not by rules of, call it competency or influence, whatever it is. It's simply how close to the seat of power are you at that point in time. And then you have poor government, policy and institutions. Because power is concentrated. It's like five people making all the decisions for a big country. It doesn't work at all. And no one ever thinks about improving governance. What that then does is you get exclusion and inequality. The economy doesn't grow. People are not educated. And then you get the outer circle, which is the poverty and the violence and war. And this reinforces itself. If you take the case of Nigeria, if you ever study Nigerian history, when Nigeria gained independence, there were only nine provinces or states in Nigeria. There are very many now. Because that the way that the leadership manages that internal political pact is that when they see a faction popping up in state X, they just carve out that state and give them a little bit of power and bring them closer to the seat of power. So it creates the illusion of change, but nothing actually changes. So if you're doing political studies or history or anything like that, it's always great to look at things more graphically so that you can understand what it implies for people. But Mandela his big issue was the fact that he was looked after by the rest of the continent when he was in exile. He lived in a whole bunch of different places along with a series of other South African leaders at the time. It hurts him. It hurt him when he was alive that South Africans had such a big issue with their fellow African brothers. And African unity was his big thing. So between him and Gaddafi, at some point in time, you would have had a United States of Africa. Even though they disagreed on how to get it done, but the ideology was there. So harmony was a big issue. Peace was a big issue. Inclusivity in all of those countries was a big issue. But obviously, the one challenge I always had with Mandela was that I think he left us too early from a political power perspective. I think he should have served two terms. Maybe we wouldn't be dealing with Jay-Z now. But that is just my humble young opinion. But that's Mandela's African dream. It was a very simple thing. A continent in harmony with itself. Because right now, Africa's biggest problem is that it's fighting within itself. There are civil wars, there's too many economic divides. It's actually quite difficult to import and export things across African borders than it would be to send it to America. It's very difficult. There's a lot of restrictions across all the different countries. If you're taking something to Zambia, you will sit at the Zimbabwean border for a while, and then you will go and sit at the Zimbabwe-Zambian border for a while. And that's not a function of just incompetence. It's just simply a system that does not recognize the need for regional integration. Because everyone's protecting their own. But then they let the Chinese get in there, which I don't understand. Okay. One of my favorite views coming from Mandela, it was the statement that any leader should not be oversensitive in the face of criticism. And I'm wondering how many people he would say this to now. Probably Uncle Bob. Uncle Bob is what we call Robert Mugabe. Because he, at some point in time, had a law that basically was going to outlaw insulting him in his country. That is ridiculous. You can't have that. And what's more important is that in a system that has some sort of a merge between tribal culture, which is what the African basis for cultural behavior is, and then you get politics where everything is a discussion, you're going to have a problem. Because I was having a conversation with one of my friends the other day, and I said, some of our African leaders do not see themselves as presidents. And I'll give you a clear example. The African National Congress identifies itself as the ruling party of South Africa. It does not ever call itself the governing party of South Africa. There is a difference between ruling and governing. A ruler sends out decrees. He says something, and therefore it shall be. A governor asks, he has to take it to parliament and his advisors and all sorts of things, and they discuss it and they vote and then it happens. See the big difference? So tribal mentality in an immature political environment is actually exceptionally, exceptionally toxic. And that's our current problem. We're dealing with leaders who think in a tribal sense, where they have their council, their small council. And if you misbehave, you're taken out of the small council and someone new is put in, which is that whole patronage thing again. And it doesn't help. And how aware is the youth of South Africa of this problem? Or are they assuming it's going to go away? Or are they completely apolitical, as I used to say I was? The next big lesson from Madiba was freedom of speech and the press. So the reason why this one is interesting to me is these two can be your greatest strength, but also your worst enemy in a system that has issues. It is the scariest manifestation of this issue is if you look at how ISIS uses social media currently to just terrify the rest of the world. That's all they're doing. They're using social media, it's free access. They're not even trying too hard. Before, it would take days to find out that someone had bombed someplace somewhere. Now it's within a matter of minutes and it's trending on Twitter. How does that impact how your students are absorbing information in the classroom and how they view their role in the world and all sorts of other things? I think it's probably the most difficult time now with technology and where it's gone to be a teacher. Because there's always going to be some paper somewhere that makes the kid think he's smarter than you, that makes him think he shouldn't sit and listen to you because he can learn this thing on Google faster than you ever could. And then there's always, of course, the PhDs we all got from Wikipedia. So freedom of the press and freedom of speech, for me, are then an interesting one. But the one thing that's very true about it, and is what Mandela said, was that no one has a monopoly on the truth. And history is written by the victor. That's what used to be said. Who's writing history now? Because the book is open. Information just spills out. People don't wait to get told what happened now. They watch it happen and then they formulate their own opinion. So how it should be harder to control them, right? So for me, I wonder what, I always look at this one and I wonder what he would say now based on the current dispensation that we have on just media and how it works and how communication systems have evolved and how people interact and absorb information and events, particularly events, because events are, Twitter is an exceptionally powerful, powerful tool. It's dangerous, but exceptionally powerful. It gets something across the globe within a matter of minutes. And before you have sat down with your advisor to formulate that speech to respond to Obama, the kid in Timbuktu has already seen it. And here's the current one that's currently bugging me. Is the time will come when our nation will honor the memory of all the sons, the daughters, the mothers, the fathers, the youth, and the children who, by their thoughts and deeds, gave us the right to assert with pride that we are South Africans, that we are African, and that we are citizens of the world. Nelson Mandela never saw a difference between a South African and an African. And South Africans currently have an identity crisis. It's a serious identity crisis. You see it in boardrooms where you'll be sitting down having a discussion about whether strategy or whatever it is, and one executive will pop out and say, but what's happening with our Africa strategy? I'm like, but you're in Africa. No, but what's happening with our Africa strategy? I'm like, but Africa's not a village. Nigeria's not the same as Kenya, so you can't have a global strategy for all of it. It also happens when you travel. I was in, I was in New York, I think. And then I was talking to a guy, and he said, so you're from South Africa? And I said, yes, yeah, I am. He said, you don't sound like you're African, eh? I'm like, oh boy. Do you know how many countries there are on the continent? Do you know how different all the people sound on the continent? Luckily, he didn't ask me that stupid question about me having a pet lion. But South Africans have a serious identity crisis at this point in time. It manifests in violence for the ignorant portions of our people. But the truth is, everyone is a foreigner somewhere. And if we're going to say that, you know, the people who should remain in a particular country should always just be the people who were there originally when there was no one else, half of all the continents would be empty. Like the Indians would be so bored in America. All right. But we need to find a solution to this identity crisis issue that South Africa has. Otherwise, we'll have more of these xenophobic attacks, or Afrophobia as they're describing it currently. And you won't find a solution because they're looking for someone to blame. People are feeling disenfranchised. People are feeling like life is not moving. And they can't get to the politically elite. So they get to the weak ones who are sitting in the streets who look different, which are our fellow African brothers and sisters. But the other thought I wanted to leave you with is, how do you go from that particular South African problem to this American problem? Is it the same issue? Or is it a different issue? And remember what I said about Mandela. His big thing was harmony. And embedded within harmony is tolerance and understanding. So obviously there's a big lesson there that some people are missing. In the same way that we're missing a big lesson around Afrophobia. But every country has some form of an identity crisis issue going on at this point in time. And some people need to sit down, some smart people, you just sit down and define it and get the average man to understand it. Because once he understands it, he might deal with it a little bit better. So the last thing I wanted to leave you with was Mandela's definition of freedom. In a simple sense, freedom is a life lived in service of the idea of empowering others. No one is as lucky and blessed as you all are, as educators, because you can say that that's what you do every day. And that's me. Thank you for having me. Minutes. I've got about 10 minutes for questions, if you have any. You can ask about anything. I'll try to answer. Don't ask me about what's happening with the Avenge stock price. I cannot answer you. There's one at the back, right there.
Thank you.
Could you stand so everyone can see you? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susie. At about midday today, I was just reminded as we're taking us through, Lorraine from United Kingdom, speaking on developing the pupils as the leaders. Two things were mentioned in that auditorium: the impartation of knowledge and skills, which are very critical to obtaining results. Taking it to Nelson Mandela, what happened to grow in the Eastern Cape, coming from a less developed schooling background, but ultimately made it as an international icon. I also come from the natural sciences, physical science and maths, but I'm grappling to find out what actually made Nelson Mandela different. Now that we are in the chapel, was it a hand of God upon him? Was it only knowledge and skills which made him able to get the results? What are your comments?
Okay, if I could answer that question, I'd probably get a free PhD. My personal opinion about the man is that the only thing that made him different was that he had vision. Mandela saw something that didn't exist, but he saw a way to get to it, and he held steadfastly to that path that he thought would work to get to it. He had vision, that's all. And the only way to ever make an average child a leader, the first step is leadership of self. They talk a lot about it at the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation when they're trying to teach leadership. It's always start with leadership of self. Whenever you try and teach someone a concept and it goes too far out, they don't grasp it. So bring it home. Start with leadership of self, which is make your own choices, make your own deadlines, control you. Because once someone realizes that they can control themselves, they start, that little sphere of control, that locus, expands. Slowly but surely, it expands. So you can't teach someone how to lead if they don't know how to lead themselves. But my 2 cents worth opinion about Nelson Mandela's uniqueness is that he had vision.
So I was going to ask that question.
Yeah.
As I sit here in this room that isn't a very diverse room, and I think about you standing before us and sharing so eloquently almost your journey and your message to us about our responsibility.
Yeah.
I'm wondering the importance of seeing beyond what we see today and how to instill that in young people, and how we teach that when we ourselves are not in diverse communities. We don't within ourselves have the infrastructure to do a lot of what you're saying. So as you stand here before us and you have a background in infrastructure, what advice might you give us?
Okay. It's very true. It's very difficult to teach what you do not understand. The first thing is, in order to teach a process of thinking, you never need to get into the details of the matter. Because the big thing here is planting the seed and then allowing for the child who then has the interest to go and dabble. And that's why I like the idea of flexible curriculums and curriculum requirements, which you don't get when you're in high school. But there are courses that allow for kids to find an area of interest and explore it. English is one great one. Whenever you ask kids to go watch something and write about something that they care about, it is an opportunity for them to identify what they like, even though you're only focusing on the technicalities of their writing capability. So my big thing about how to understand a lot of different things without actually going into the details of all those things, apart from reading Wikipedia pages, is read it, watch it, and talk about it. It's how humans learn. Read it, watch it, talk about it. So there's a lot of different materials out there about the African infrastructure backlog, African politics. There's a lot of different materials on development initiatives. I found one great book when I was 19 that talked about the Ying dynasty and how it's still impacting China's political doctrine and the way they live. And it gave me a snapshot, and because all you need is a big enough snapshot to formulate an opinion, and always remembering that there is no such thing as an incorrect opinion. That's how kids learn. So read it, watch it, talk about it. It's the only thing you can do. So multimedia is a very great medium if you can find it. And we just have to find ways to make sure that we're engaging with all of those things more and more as educators, as kids, as parents particularly. Because what I found is if you're going to try and take something to the classroom and you have children at home and you've never had a discussion with them, it's going to be more difficult because you don't know how they'll absorb it, especially if it's outside the bounds of your curriculum. So the discussions you're having at home as a primary basis should formulate where your personal interests are and the things that you're trying to learn as an individual. So start there. And as you get more comfortable with the subject matter, then bring the kids in. Because there's nothing worse than a parent trying to teach or a teacher trying to teach contextual education and scarring the kids. Because that can happen. There's one there.
So schools such as Bishop's, Rondebosch, Sachs, and many other schools throughout the country have development programs where we go out into the community and identify talented children, be they sports, be they academics, but various children with some ability. We bring them into these high school environments and we put mentorship programs in place to try and ensure the well-being, the success of these children. With various degrees of success. Some are successful in their chosen discipline, others don't succeed. So here's my question to you. Are we being fair to the children who don't succeed? By offering them that opportunity, you place them in this environment of privilege when they've come from very, very underprivileged backgrounds and they really struggle to fit in, to grasp this new environment and to make a success of it. So I'm referring specifically to those that don't make a success of it and the programs and the continuation thereof.
I've been asked the question before, but in a different forum. The Alan Gray Orbis Foundation has the Scholars Program, which it does exactly that. It goes and finds kids in very disadvantaged areas, brings them in, and puts them in a Bishop's. The kid still has to go home at the end of the term to a very, very sad home environment, and it does affect them. If I am being philosophical, my answer to you will be fix the baseline problem, fix his school. Use all the money that you would use while he's here to fix his school. And if he's a brilliant kid, he'll make it out of that school. But that's a philosophical answer. The real answer is somewhere in between the two. You have to give access to someone who shows potential. You can't control how they respond to it. So you have to choose between two evils. Do you help one child Or do you help 50, but you only move them an inch, versus moving one child by a mile? It's entirely a philosophical problem that you have to live with. It's very simple. So you pick. Are we good? I'm done. Where's my iPad?
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm fairly proud to be a South African today when you've heard two keynote speakers of the quality that we have heard, and two keynote speakers who've certainly made us think to the extent that they have, and who are providing such leadership in their own spheres of life. And I commend Susie for what she's done today, because she's made us think, she's sensitized us, and in many ways energized us to go forward. I really like some of the pictures she showed and the comments she made. One struck a chord with me when she said that the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation took young children, took students and into their programs, but they nurtured their talent, they ignited their passion, and then they stood by them and helped them. And I think that's what we're all trying to do in our schools. What you have done today, Susie, is you've given us hope, well, given me hope. I detected a note of hope running through the whole speech today, and that there's so much potential for us to make a difference. And it's a very exciting time to be part of education now, I feel, because we're entering into a new world in so many ways, and we have to be aware of issues like we've heard today. At the same time, it was quite humbling today, because we've got an enormous responsibility going forward and taking the young people that we teach into the future. But again, running through the whole speech was a note of humor, which we thoroughly enjoyed. So, Sue, thanks for coming out today. I hope that someone says of my school one day that they're a bunch of crazy kids who are going to make a difference in the world. Thanks, crazy kid, for helping make a difference.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes our formal program for the day. If you are going to the home dinners, won't you please remain in the chapel? And for the rest of you, we'll see you at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Thank you.